Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Stargazing with Star Fuentes. Star Fuentes is a master intuitive healer and spiritual teacher and has been a pioneering student of metaphysics for over 50 years. She has learned lifetimes of priceless information from her years of seeking out and living with indigenous healers and shamans around the world. Visit her website at www.starfuentes.com and then join her here every Wednesday night on Spiritual Connections Radio as she shares her knowledge with you. And now, Star Fuentes.
Welcome. After the half hour, we will be answering some questions. The number 646-716-9663. I'm very excited. Today, we have with us Bruce Rolfe. Welcome, Bruce.
Well, welcome, Sarah. Thank you for having me on your show. Appreciate it.
That's great. Now, you and I have both been fascinated with sacred geometry for decades. Tell me about your interest in sacred geometry and where it has taken you this lifetime.
Sure, I'll be happy to. It started at a very early age. I was always kind of interested in finding out, you know, what's universal, what doesn't change, what stays the same no matter what. And so an early interest in mathematics, because generally the laws of mathematics and the theorems of geometry and things like that don't change regardless of who you are or how much money you have or what planet you're on or all that kind of stuff. So I kind of got into that, and I always enjoyed geometry, you know, even in high school and grade school. And then when I got into college, I found out about this thing called the golden ratio, and through a couple of different books that my mom, who's been a spiritual mentor my whole life, I'm fortunate to say, and one of them was The Secrets of the Great Pyramid by Peter Tompkins. And in that, there's a whole chapter devoted to the geometry of the Great Pyramid at Giza, Egypt, which I had the pleasure of visiting with Greg Braden, and there's 21 of us in the fall of 1992, so it's been over two decades since I was there. We got to go inside the inner chambers and passageways of that amazing structure. And then the other book, again, in my kind of early college years, that got me hooked on the golden ratio, so to speak, was a book called This Living Earth by David Cavagnaro, which is sort of a coffee table book that had lots of pictures of nature, really beautiful photography. And there was just a brief mention of this thing called the golden ratio, or the divine proportion. It goes by a lot of different names. And he talks about in that book how items in nature follow this design of this, really the principle of interconnectedness, I like to think of it, because the golden ratio, as it turns out, that it appears not only in the biological world, as the second book I referred to mentions, but also in, it was immortalized in 13 acres of stone in Giza, Egypt, you know, 2.6 million, something like that, granite limestone blocks with incredible accuracy in the proportions of this Great Pyramid that has been attributed to Cheops, which I think is kind of like calling the White House, the Bush House, or the Obama House. you know, those people may have lived there, but there's probably a purpose that predates that and is more generalized than just those specific occupants. And I think the same thing is true with the Great Pyramid, attributing it to a particular pharaoh who I think that even in the early dynasties were Johnny-come-latelys to this ancient structure. Anyway, the five ratio, or the golden ratio, was immortalized in that structure by way of the apothem, which is a fancy mathematical word for the line that goes from the top or apex of the pyramid down to the midpoint of any of the four base sides. And then from that midpoint, if you take a line that goes along the base, which is half the length of the base, that ratio of the apothem to one half of the base side is that golden ratio, two or three decimal points. And also, it also has the pi proportion and just tons of mathematics. We could talk probably fill the rest of the half hour just talking about the mathematics and the amazing quote-unquote synchronicities of the Great Pyramid. But anyway, I'll just touch on it for now. But It's just an amazing structure, and that coincidence, if you will.
Well, it's not a coincidence. Doesn't the hair on my head grow like that? Doesn't the sunflower grow like that?
I say that tongue-in-cheek as a coincidence, because obviously the synchronicities are just too astonishing for it to be coincidental. But I say that with a, you know, tongue planted firmly in cheek, like poking fun at that idea that it's accidental, because I mean everything has a purpose, and we can find that purpose, I think, by finding going back to the mind, looking at the thought systems that the Hermetic philosophy that I've been studying, and I've tied into the Great Pyramid with what I've been working on recently, relates to the fact that there really is an order and a plan and a purpose for everything in the world, and we can either use it to integrate or disintegrate depending on how we look at it. We can either use it for kindness or for cruelty. We can use it for bringing our awareness back into oneness, or we can use it in a divisive manner. So I find that the what's become known as sacred geometry, and since you asked me if I would talk a little bit about how I got into this, that there were those two books that I found in my late high school, early college years that both mentioned the five proportion, which is the 1.618, roughly. It goes on out to infinity. It's the actual exact proportion is 1 plus the square root of 5 divided by 2, which if you do the quadratic formula for an equation that's phi or phi, or sometimes the Greek letter tau is used, plus 1 equals that same number squared, or 5 plus 1 equals 5 squared. And I think mathematically that's a really interesting symbolism, because what you have going on is you have this proportion, this number, this ratio, that is symbolized by, you know, the Greek letter phi or tau, depending on which one you like, or phi, sometimes pronounced that way. And if you add 1 to it, or symbolically integrate that with oneness, it brings that number to a higher power, to a higher dimension, to a higher order of awareness, if you will. So so when you work out that quadratic formula on it, it turns out that you can divide a line by the phi proportion, or any distance, or any measurement of any kind, musically, you can do it on musical intervals and all kinds of things, by that golden ratio. And it turns out that if you take the example of a line and you divide a line by the golden ratio, the ratio of the larger portion of that divided line to the smaller portion is the same exact ratio as the whole, the sum of the two pieces, to the larger portion. So it gets into the realm of what's called fractals. And the idea of a fractal is that there's this interrelatedness. And people in your audience may be familiar with the principle of what's called the coastline phenomena. That as you zoom into a coastline, you start seeing more and more detail, and the farther you zoom into it, you get down to a molecular level where there's grains of sand on a beach, and pretty soon you have this infinite coastline, right? But the idea is that you can zoom in and out, and you see a similar kind of pattern, and this is particularly true with things that are related by the golden ratio. So a five-pointed star is a perfect example of that, and the Great Pyramid of Giza has that proportion encoded into it, just as chambered nautilus shells and fiddle ferns and spiral galaxies and the populations of rabbits that breed follow this Fibonacci series that was credited by an Italian named Leonardo da Pisa, who went by the nickname of Fibonacci, and this mathematical sequence was attributed to him that basically suggests that you can take again, oneness and oneness, or unity and unity. And if you add those together, you get 2, right? 1 and 1 makes 2. Pretty straightforward.
Oh, good. Most missed sequence on an IQ test? 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, the next number, is the most missed on an IQ test. Isn't that amazing?
13 is the most missed?
Well, yeah, filling in that blank because people don't get that. Let's talk a little bit about the platonic solids.
Sure, sure.
And what is your website so people can go see the amazing things you've done with sacred geometry?
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Dar. This is geometrycode.com. And there's a whole bunch of stuff on there on the resources page. And I have a monthly bulletin that goes out that's free. And also, if people want to subscribe to more periodic updates, you can do that on the homepage as well. And then the resources page has tons of stuff. And there's a lot of free things, which includes a full models of the Platonic and Archimedes.
Well, the foldouts are incredible. I've been, you know, doing those for years, you know.
They're fun.
And the Archimedean solids, too. So that's pretty good. Let's talk about the Platonic solids and a little bit of info on that for our newbies out there and for our light language people, too.
Sure, sure. Well, they're attributed to Plato, who is one of my, you know, historical heroes, because he not only was fascinated with these geometric shapes as well, but he also, I think, I'm just going to digress a little bit and we'll get back to the geometric shapes, but he also, I think, had a tremendous philosophical impact on Western civilization. And his allegory of the cave, I think, is wonderful because he talks about how, you know, we're all like prisoners that have been chained together in the dark, and all we can see is our shadows in a dimly lit cave. And that's all we know. And I think that is really an excellent metaphor, a description of what we are doing in the three-dimensional physical world of space and time. Is we have such a tiny little window on the cosmos that we tend to take the little bit we think we know and extrapolate it and exaggerate and distort and and make a lot of assumptions. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I think, you know, sometimes it can get us in a little bit of trouble when we try to extrapolate a little too far and second guess things. I like the metaphor also of flatland. If you can imagine people that live in a two-dimensional world, which Edwin Abbott talks about in his classic book about flatland, if you wanted to play a prank on somebody that lived in a two-dimensional world, all you have to do is poke a pencil through their quote, reality, unquote, of two dimensions, and they would be suddenly hallucinating that suddenly this black dot appeared out of nowhere, and then the pencil goes through their paper world a little farther, say, oh, now it's a brown circle, and then a yellow hexagon, and then it would be that shape for a while, and then finally, oh, now it's a pink circle when they get to the eraser, right? And finally,
uh-huh.
And it disappears, and then it disappeared, call the National Enquirer, you know, whatever the current, you know, psychic rag might be du jour. But I think that's kind of how we live our lives, and I think it ties into the wisdom of Plato's insight of saying, well, what is it for, and why do we assume that we have a whole story when we have such a tiny glimpse on things? We have such a finite grasp on reality, given what our senses tell us. But we have to go by, you know, certainly we wouldn't want to discount what our senses tell us. So then jumping back to what Plato's known for in the realm of geometry, there are these five solids that are also called five regular polygons, five regular polyhedra, in the three-dimensional realm. There are an infinite number of regular polygons in two dimensions. And then actually what happens when you get into higher dimensional realms in fourth dimension and so on, there's actually a mathematically robust set of what are called polytopes and polychora. And on the resources page on Geometry Code, I have some links to some amazing imagery that a fellow geometer who unfortunately recently passed on named Russell Toll did. But he allowed me to put those on the website, some animations of some four-dimensional shapes that he did some animations of where each slice through a four-dimensional shape is one frame of the animation. And if you can kind of imagine that, because we can't really grok what these really are like. But I think it's another example of how, you know, our minds are capable of things that our physical senses just can't quite get. And the mind that tries to to, you know, rely on the physical senses is also at a loss. But okay, now I think I've digressed enough, so I want to get back to, since you asked very, very politely about the Platonic sonnets, which are ascribed to Plato, and obviously have been around a lot longer than he was around, but those were five mystical shapes in three dimensions, and the simplest, or probably the most familiar anyway, for most people, is a cube, which is also known as a hexahedron, is six-sided. And Plato ascribed some of the primary elements to each of these shapes, and to the cube he ascribed the element earth. And it does seem like it's a very earthy kind of a shape, and we build our houses based on rectilinear cubic types of geometry and all our structures, and so much of our particularly Western rectilinear world is based on cubic architecture. And then the dual to that, or the polyhedra, or the Platonic solid in this case, more specifically, that is the mirror, if you will, of that, which is formed by connecting the midpoints of each of the six faces, each of the six square faces of the cube. If you can imagine doing that, you get an eight-sided shape, which is the octahedron, and the octahedron is composed of eight equilateral triangles. And so now we have the duality between earth and air, because Plato ascribed the element air to the octahedron. And that seems like an airy kind of a shape, I suppose, if you wanted to look at it that way. And,
it does. It also looks to me like spirit and matter come together in the center of it, you know. That's kind of there. I like that shape. And then what we get?
I'm fond of them all, actually. I think they're all fascinating.
I have favorites every day, but they're not favorite for many days.
So
Nassim, where the physicist Nassim, what's his
Hartman?
Name? How much emphasis he puts on the cubo octahedron?
Yes, he does put quite a bit of emphasis on that, and I think there's some validity to that. Another fascinating body of work that he's amassed, and working with different colleagues like Elizabeth Rauscher and doing some interesting cosmological work there. Should we return to that and finish the Platonic
Solid? Let's return to where
we were. Because we could spend another hour easy talking about the kinds of things that Nassim's work touches on.
Yeah, but let's go back to your understanding of sacred geometry and your exploration of it.
Oh, sure. Okay. So the other three shapes in the Platonic Solid quintet of five shapes, there's two more that are duals of each other, which is the icosahedron, which Plato suggested represented water. And now that shape is composed of 20 equilateral triangles. And that's probably because there's so many faces, it's probably the closest to a sphere. And it's a linear shape, but you can imagine that fitting inside a sphere, as they all do, actually, or a sphere fitting inside each of those. And in fact, in my first book, I have a list of tables of how the in-sphere, inter-sphere, and circum-sphere all relate geometrically and down to, I don't know, 8 or 9, 10 decimal points, something like that. If anybody wants to experiment with those proportions, it's interesting there. It's one of the references in the back of the book. And the icosahedron is this really elegant shape that has as its dual and Plato ascribed water to the icosahedron. The dual to the icosahedron is the dodecahedron, and that is the shape that he attributed to ether or spirit. And I certainly one of my favorite shapes. I think it's cosmologically and mystically got all kinds of interesting connections, including some astrophysicists that have postulated that maybe our universe might even be in the shape of a dodecahedron, but who knows? we'd have to step back from the cosmos. I'm not sure how you'd do that other than mentally to really see if that's true or not. But it's fun to contemplate that. But anyway, he ascribed that to spirit. And so you can, any dual, which is of which there are two pairs of the Platonics that are different shapes that are duals, you can take the center point of this dodecahedron, which is made out of 12 pentagons, and if you find the midpoint of each of those pentagons and draw lines together to the nearest face of the dodecahedron, you end up with the icosahedron and back and forth. And actually, it turns out you can nest all five of those shapes. And I have an animation on Geometry Code. It's the third one down in the middle of the page where I've got four videos stacked on top of each other that says Nested Platonics Recursion. And I put that together with a program called Pavre several years ago to show how you can make an infinite fractal that zooms in or out, and it's exactly 27 times the volume as you zoom in from a square to then the tetrahedron, which is the fifth shape, which we'll wrap this up as quickly as we can. and the tetrahedron is actually the simplest shape in terms of the number of faces. It's actually just only four, tetra meaning four, and hedron meaning side again. So the tetrahedron is a three-sided pyramid, if you will, but unlike the Great Pyramid of Giza that has four, you've got three that are made out of equilateral triangles. So each face is exactly the same as it's true of all of the five platonic solids. And in this case, the last element that Plato ascribed to the tetrahedron was the element of fire. Now, interestingly enough, and I think sort of almost symbolically, the fire element of the tetrahedron is dual to itself. So a fire could be likened symbolically or metaphorically to the spark of consciousness or awareness. Then it has no generator other than itself, and that there's nothing that pre-exists that awareness. So I think that's kind of interesting symbolically, that spark is primary. It's not something that is begat because of something. Metaphorically, if you will. One of the things I find fascinating about the tetrahedron, since Plato suggested it relates to the element of fire, is that around the planet, and in both the back of the first book I did and also on the website, the Geometry Code website, I have a list of some of the places on the planet that have a lot of volcanic activity at the plus or minus 19.47 degrees latitude, roughly 19.5 degrees latitude, north and south of the equator. Well, it turns out that Mauna Kea, there's a Mauna Loa, I'll get those confused. Anyway, the one on the Big Island, that is in a semi-perpetual state of eruption. And we flew over the active lava flow, my wife and I, in a helicopter some years ago, and it was fascinating. If you get a chance to do it, it's amazing. Excursion. We sat through a dreary timeshare sales pitch in order to get two for one tickets to fly over that, but it was worth every penny of it. Because I mean, just to see, you know, the Pele Juju, if you will, of Mother Earth's active lava flow, and it was just an incredible experience. But that's happening at the 19.5 degree latitude on our planet, as is the big volcano in Mexico City, and there's a handful of them scattered around the planet, and probably statistically more than other places where there are volcanoes. Obviously, there's other places on the planet with volcanoes, but interestingly enough, now I'm getting to the point of why this ties in the tetrahedron. If you take this three-sided pyramid, this tetrahedron, put one point, let's say that what's called apex, if you have a, you know, sitting on a triangular base, of course, at the north or south pole, doesn't matter which one, just pick one. And then the other three points, if you superimpose essentially a tetrahedron over the planet, which is roughly a sphere, it's actually a spheroid flattened to the poles, which ties in the Great Pyramid, but again, that's another side topic. If you take that shape, the places where the other three points on the tetrahedron, the other three vertices, intersect the globe are at that 19.47 degree latitude line. So the North Pole tetrahedron would define an arc that's at 19.5 degrees south latitude, and the opposite tetrahedron, which would be its dual partner, with the South Pole point, would then define a circular latitude line at the 19 plus 19, or the north latitude of plus 19.5 degrees. So you could say, well, that's kind of coincidental.
Yeah. And what do we commonly call those two shapes together like that?
The star tetrahedron, or also stella octangula, as Leonardo da Vinci called it. It goes by a number of other names, but those are two of the primary ones. Essentially, it's a tetrahedron that's dual to itself, where one of the dual members is expanded out to be the same size as the other one. So you have this interesting shape that ties into a lot of the work that Drumville and Melchizedek, who a lot of your listeners are probably familiar with, has put together, and the Merkaba, and all kinds of fascinating stuff. But to finish up with the fire symbolism of the tetrahedron, it turns out that we're not the only planet, even in our own solar system, that has volcanic activity. And when the NASA's Voyager program shot a probe past one of Jupiter's moons, Io, which is has the only other known volcanic activity in our solar system, at least from last I read anyway, it turns out when they mapped out where this volcano was at, you could Google it and find, volcano on Jupiter's moon Io, and you'll find it. I believe it was at that 19.5 degree latitude point. So maybe Plato was onto something, And I know you've done a lot of work with the symbolism, but I pretty much stick to what Plato's elements were, because I figured, he didn't go too much into symbolism, but he definitely ascribed those five elements to those Platonic solids. And then so the Archimedean solids, which are sort of like morphing one of the Platonics into each other, for the most part, except for the two snubs, which are kind of oddballs, but interesting oddballs, as they all are, you can actually make the Archimedean solids by shaving off or truncating the vertices in a very predefined, very careful way. And you'll find that as you do, you hit these midpoints and places where all these other Archimedean solids, of which there are 13, suddenly appear by shaving off the corners, if you will, of the Platonic solids. And again, they nest together really nicely. So if you get a chance and you go to geometrycode.com, that third animation down in the middle of
the dodecagold.
No, it's the one above that, actually. It's the nested platonics recursion.
The nested platonics.
Have you ever
had a nested platonic shape that's made out of all copper with them nested in each other?
No, but I've made one out of zone tool, and it's sitting in my closet, in fact.
Yeah, well, I notice I have a copper one. And I notice when I start waving that thing around, and not necessarily waving it around in circles, but playing and working with it, well, it is excellent for moving into dimensions. It is excellent for taking you 10 to 15% farther than you normally can stretch. And the nested platonics, for me, if you're slow, they move slow for you. If you're medium speed, they move medium for you. So there's several people on the internet you can buy that from, and I'm sure you could teach us all how to create that. If you do dimensional work, it's a really interesting tool for you.
Neat, yeah. Yeah, there's all kinds of amazing things you can do with those shapes. And so this animation shows how they all fit together. And I think that's what I keep coming back to, is the interconnectedness. Rather than obsessing over, a subset of the shapes, but what is the purpose and why are they useful? And I think, again, I touched on it early in the conversation, that if we can find what's universal and what allows us to identify a thought system of inclusion or integration, we can use the golden ratio, for example, and all these shapes that are interrelated and interconnected, and the idea of fractality, that the more you zoom in and the more you zoom out, the more it looks the same. And I think it's that sameness that is sort of the interconnectedness is a bridge concept or a gateway concept to the oneness that is really at the essence of our metaphysical spiritual nature. And I think that's what I keep coming back to.
Well, that's a good point to come back. And we're coming up on our station, our half our break here. And one thing I'd like to say is about the Our Committee in Solids, that most of the seeds, bacteria, and viruses take shapes of the Our Committee in Solids.
Yeah.
And I think I'm ready for our half-show break now.
You're listening to Stargazing with Star Fuentes. Star Fuentes is a master intuitive healer and spiritual teacher and has been a pioneering student of metaphysics for over 50 years. She has learned lifetimes of priceless information from her years of seeking out and living with indigenous healers and shamans around the world. Visit her website at www.starfuentes.com and then join her here every Wednesday night on Spiritual Connections Radio as she shares her knowledge with you. Once again, Star Fuentes.
Bruce, I know that your work is incredible, and I know that you will be at the Light Language Conference in 2015. Could you please elaborate about some of your products, the Sacred Geometry Design Source Book, and about how full your website is of information and blogs and animations? And that is the geometrycode.com. All you light language people, get on there now. Talk to us, Bruce, about some of your products.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah, the first book, the Sacred Geometry Design Source Book, is really an outgrowth of just doing the classic thing of taking compass and straight edge and just like the Greek mathematicians and geometers and Egyptians before them, replicating things like the flower of life and dividing a line by the golden ratio and all those kinds of classic constructions, taking a circle and inscribing a pentagon or making a pentagon from a line segment. Just all those kinds of things are in there, as well as a whole lot of different tessellations, the two-dimensional shapes. And then all the I put literally all the Platonic and Archimedean solid fold-up patterns on the website. So if you want to get a flavor for what's in the book in the three-dimensional realm, that's there as well. But essentially what I was doing is I was working as a software engineer in Northern California in the late 1990s, and I was using a CAD program to design control panels for the video broadcast industry. And my wife was taking an evening class, and and on Wednesday evenings, I think it was, and I thought, well, gee, I could start taking some of this backlog of images I've been drawing by hand for years and use this CAD program. And after about a year of doing that, it kind of spilled over past how long my wife was taking this class, and it kind of became a passionate to see how much I could put on this Claris CAD program at the time. And by the time I was done, I had like 1,300 different variations of geometric archetypes, and obviously there's countless more, but I was trying to pick the ones that I thought were, relatively universal and had a quality to them that kind of speaks beyond the language of words that we try to use. I think crop circles are another example of that. I only have one crop circle image in that particular book. But a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, are fascinated, as I am, with the symbolism and the language that comes through beyond the words, I think, at a deeper level, in terms of how those geometric archetypes can speak to us more directly than words in many cases. So that first book really is a compendium or a collection of almost all images. There's only 11 pages of text in there. But I made it spiral bound because I wanted the people who got the book to be able to lay it flat on a copy machine and use it as a coloring book for kids of any age, basically. The kaleidoscopic patterns and the fold-up patterns and all the things that they're just fun to play with. And so, again, that's why I made it spiral bound. Go ahead.
Do you have a newer book now?
Yes. Yeah, I was just going to say that the second book is an outgrowth of studying the Hermetic laws, which I actually found in the early 70s, about the same time I got introduced to what then became known as sacred geometry, and I was actually exposed to that term by a colleague of ours named Greg Braden, who gave a talk in my mom's living room in 1991 before he became a little better known. And anyway, Greg introduced me to the work of Drumbal Melchizedek, and that's basically what led to a renaissance of interest in, I learned then, was the body melt called sacred geometry. And then, but at the same time, I learned about the Hermetic laws, and there was this 100-year-old book called the Kabbalion, not to be confused with the Kabbalah, but the Kabbalion talks about 7 Hermetic laws, which are mentalism, correspondence, vibration, polarity, rhythm, cause and effect, and gender or generation. And again, the universality of these laws really had tremendous appeal to me, because I keep wanting to find what's universal. It doesn't change regardless of what culture you are involved in or what planet you're on or all that kind of stuff. I want to find things that don't change with time or space. And so those Hermetic laws seem to fit very nicely with that. And that led to another parallel study in non-dual metaphysics, which led me into A Course in Miracles in the mid-80s. And then I kind of got out away from that for a while, set it aside, and then got back into it about 7 years ago. So when I started to put the second book together, I'd already conceived of a connection with these 7 Hermetic laws with 7 geometric shapes. And I think they fit very nicely. And the law of mentalism, which is the first one, if you think in terms of the circle and an infinitely expanding circle or sphere in 3 dimensions, the sphere of our awareness then can encompass the entire cosmos. So there's a tremendous, in fact, you might say the primary geometric shape could be arguably the point expanding to an infinite sphere that encompasses everything. And so I think that's such a very primary symbol. And the mind, again, is so primary, because without the mind, the entire ephemeral world really is just a projection of that. It's a representation of an internal state that we've chosen on some level that we may not be conscious of, but we can become aware of that by expanding our sphere of identity and including everyone in that circle. And I think that's an important principle that ties into, well, all these other Hermetic laws, which I'm going to jump to the fourth one, which is the law of polarity, or polarization. That one, if you think in terms of a line and opposites, you have all kinds of polarities in our world, hot and cold, light and dark, up and down, so forth and so on. And,
oh, boy, yeah.
I mean, but the idea of polarization is so ingrained in us that to think of something that is not polarized is antithetical. It's just so foreign to us that we can't hardly imagine it. And yet that's where I think the deepest peace and the deepest sense of inner comfort lies, is when we can go beyond the polarizations that divide us as people or as nations or as, you know, cultural groups of any kind or planets. I mean, you know, maybe if we get all our act together as a planet and get along with each other, the next thing will be, oh, it's those darn people from planet whatever, you know.
So it's
all silly because I think that the principles that the Hermetic laws lead us toward, that Plato's philosophy leads us toward, that sacred geometry leads us toward, if we're looking at for it, is this principle of interconnectedness that ties us into the oneness that we all share, that allows us to look beyond our grievances and our victimhoods and our differences and our you know, specialness and our stuff and all our, to quote George Carlin and the staff, you know, all of our baggage, you know, that we carry around with us that makes differences important. And when we can look at that and expand our sphere of understanding in our mind to include everyone, obviously, if you have a potluck, it's not too practical to invite 7 billion people on the planet plus, but in our hearts, we can include everyone. And I think that's the key idea. So moving to the next one, the next Hermetic law, the law of correspondence, the as above, so below, as within, so without. And the more I contemplated these geometric shapes, the more I realized, well, the Vesica Pisces is a beautiful symbol for that, because it essentially, for those of your listeners who may not be familiar with that shape, it's essentially the intersection or the overlapping of two identical circles in such a way that the circumference or the outer periphery of one circle touches the center or the heart of the opposite circle. And so if you look at that shape, it looks like an almond, or it's also called a mandorla. Vesica Pisces actually means fish bladder, but
oh,
I guess that's the shape that must have been originally, you know, in the mind of whoever coined the phrase. But if you think about what that looks like, it's, well, a human eye. And, you know, there's this classic phrase, the eye is the mirror of the soul. So when we look out at what appear to be others, what we're really seeing is a mirror or reflection of our internal state. And I think that can be metaphysically tremendously helpful when we recognize that what we're seeing is not so much a prison necessarily, but a classroom if we turn it around to an inclusive paradigm and recognize that everything that passes our sphere of awareness and it gets projected out through the lens, which is another metaphor for Vesica Pisces, another description or name for it, the lens of our awareness in this material world as a classroom exercise. So we get to look at all the things that are in our unconscious mind that are projected out through this lens. And so as within, so without. As within our mind, go back to the first Hermetic law, the sphere of our mind then, which really is all encompassing, nothing really leaves that source. But the reflection of that we seem to see in this world is all these other people and other things that mirror for us or reflect just like the projection really of our mind. And the lens that is responsible for making that projection, in the case of our eye, is actually shaped literally as a Vesica Pisces shape. And it then projects out on this cosmos. But we actually have so much backwards. We think that the cosmos impinges on us. We've sort of forgotten about that it's a feedback loop, and it's really our minds that are primary. And I think that's what kind of freaked out the physicist a few decades ago when quantum mechanics was born. And they called it the Copenhagen interpretation, in fact, because a lot of them met in Denmark and Copenhagen. And they recognized that because of what they were discovering in the lab, that a wave and a particle were observable depending on the expectations of the observer, that they could no longer exclude mind from the equation. Physics suddenly got turned on its head. And all these physicists like Einstein and Bohr and Planck and Heisenberg looked at each other and said, what are we going to tell the world?
Yeah, it's
because so suddenly mind was not just an inconvenient truth that we have to, you know, somehow maybe, you know, fit into our theories of physics. Now it was suddenly, wait a minute, maybe mind is primary and the materiality that we've so glorified and cherished is secondary. You know, I catch up on how they said it, but that was probably the gist of what was going through their minds. But it's a projection, and I think that's the idea that the correspondence between what is in our minds and our hearts is projected out and given to us as a spiritual classroom, moment to moment, to look at is can be tremendously helpful and tremendously practical. And so when people sometimes ask me, well, what's practical about sacred geometry? Well, just think of the lens of your mind and the geometry of the Vesica Pisces is a shape that's really how I look at the world. How I see you is how I see myself.
Well, you know, it's very interesting because I have clients who are facing the world as victims. And
uh-huh.
I see them standing in the center there, and the way they look at things, they absolutely attract all the inappropriate negative things. And if they turn around and just look at the other side of that circle, then the positive appropriate things happen. And some people, of course, face upward or downward. And you need to learn how to place yourself in the world so that you notice, observe, see, and become the part that you want to be. the master or the victim. So if we think of somebody, we put a little doll and stand them on the directly in the middle between the two circles, we will notice that when their thinking is one way, these things manifest and are mirror to them.
Right.
We turn the person up or down, I'm more confused on what happens there. It's a little bit of everything. And turn the little person the other way, and I have taken, I'm probably a girl, I've taken a doll and I've put them in sacred geometries and then looked at the world around me and say, this person is in a circle. They can't make a decision. They have 360 degrees of choices. The best shape for them would be the dodecahedron. 12 choices with 5 sides to each one. They wouldn't be rolling around, and they'd be able to make a decision. So I've worked a lot with the energetic matrix. And what is your website again? I keep forgetting.
Well, that's geometrycode.com. And thank you for asking.
And the thing I'm doing now is I'm working with Enochian magic. Are you familiar with John Dee?
What's the last name?
Okay. Well, anyway, what I'm doing, my next time magic class, is the Enochian watchtowers with their related sacred geometries.
Okay.
So that's kind of heady. You know, it's way out there, but, you know, what we know about the watchtowers is that they guard an area until you're energetically ready and vibratory ready to step through that area. So it's you know, I got the Archimedeans and the Platonic, but nothing quite comes up to the number 30. So I'm working very, very hard on those 30 watchtowers.
Okay. Interesting.
So, yeah, it's I'm kind of out there. You know, people go, huh? You're inside sacred geometry and what? Okay, what's that? But to me, it's very natural to apply sacred geometry to personality, sacred geometry to belief systems, behaviors, and seeing and being in the world. If you're in a cube, you're gonna do it the same way you've always done it, and you're gonna argue about doing it any way new, and your friends will call you square. You know, and the native English language has so much magic in it. You know, we tell people, you know, oh look, he's well rounded. And that the person who knows this is a sphere, knows a little bit of everything, you know, and the different colors we use for the different emotions. And when we dig deeply into the essence of the universe and the Platonic solids and the Archimedeans, the Catlins, the beautiful Tauruses and Mobiuses that are out there, we can actually determine what are we behaving like, what is our life like, is this appropriate for me, or do I want to become another shape? And to do that, you have to have a deep knowledge of what the shape is and what kind of energy it attracts. And just the basic fire, water, air, earth, ether energies are really important to who you are.
Right.
So what are you working on next, Bruce?
Well, I'm working on actually doing some podcasting. I've been doing some interviews online with other students and practitioners of non-dual metaphysics, particularly A Course in Miracles. Which is, I've been fascinated with, kind of got back into that 7 years ago by stumbling upon a book by Gary Renard called The Disappearance of the Universe, which is a brilliant work that led me back to this spiritual masterpiece known as The Course in Miracles, which really gets into the non-dual metaphysics that has informed a lot of what became the foundation of the work in the second book, the Geometry Code book. So the projects I'm working on now are a continuation of some of the geometric archetypes I've done before on the geometry code side. And then I also have another website called ACIN Blog that has to do with the Course in Miracles. And so that this next book I'm working on will be probably more emphasizing that non-dual metaphysical system.
Right, and are you going to do, you're going to do some video podcasts for us where we can go and pay for them on your website and learn something?
That's one of the many things that are in my to-do basket, my to-do list. So, yep, it's in the list there. I have a bunch of things I'm working on, but that's one of them. So
that would be wonderful. And I'm going to first at the Light Language Conference, which is in June here at the dome. I live in a dome. You know, I don't think I'd be satisfied with any type of cubic shape. I live in a dome, and we'll have the Light Language Conference here in June, and Bruce will be speaking at that, and we're looking forward to that. You can go to masteryourlight.com or starfuentes.com. and find out about that. Bruce, do you do sessions?
Sorry, it's a little interference there. You said something about YouTube?
Do you do YouTube too?
Yes, I have. You know, it's like say several videos of geometry on YouTube, and just a whole bunch. I'm into way too many things, but have fun with it. But I suppose I could actually wrap up the conversation about the Hermetic Laws, because I think your listeners might find
that interesting. I think that's important. Let's talk about the Hermetic Laws.
Okay. And that's really the backbone of what's in the second book, which is basically, again, the law of mentalism, which relates to the sphere, the law of correspondence, which would be the Vesica Pisces, the as above, so below, as within, so without. The third one, which you just touched on when you talked about color and vibration, is, naturally enough, the law of vibration, which basically says everything vibrates, everything has a frequency or harmonics and those kinds of vibratory qualities to it. And certainly that's true in our material world, that our five physical senses give us vibratory information of one kind or another. And so I think a sine wave, which is basically a two-dimensional representation of a spherical geometry, but we because we're so linearly oriented, we tend to flatten things out. And so a sine wave, that makes a nice symbol for the law of vibration. And then the next law, we've already touched on, the law of polarity. A line, or essentially, if you want to extend it into multiple dimensions, a cross or a three-dimensional cross, essentially anything that has axes, our Cartesian coordinates would be another good example of the law of polarity. Is anything that we map that has pluses and minuses and to and fro and different variables. But interestingly enough, that if we really dig deep metaphysically into all of these Hermetic laws, including the law of polarity, we find that by going beyond the polarizations, by seeing the intrinsic sameness of all points on any line or any dimension, we are drawn back to the understanding that there's an intrinsic oneness. So you could say, well, hot and cold are opposites, but they're both temperature. They're both aspects of a quality of something that has that same quality, no matter how hot or cold you get. So I think the law of polarity can be really helpful when we recognize that when we, for example, applying it to something more practical, have what appear to be differences of opinion, whether they be political or domestic or economic or gender, or you know, pick any polarity that seems to be something that makes the news, sexual orientation, just you name it. There's a whole gamut of stuff that people get polarized about, and yet if we look at the fact that we really are all looking for the same thing, we're all seeking that same integration, that same oneness, that same peace that comes from transcending our differences, we can use the law of polarity either to deepen the egoic agenda, if you will, or we can turn it around and say no to the default of that, you know, me first thinking, and say, well, what if I emphasize shared interests? What if I look at what we have in common that unites us, and that turns it around? And sometimes that will lead to specific actions and behaviors, but even if it doesn't, there's an awareness that says, ah, you and I are the same intrinsically. Now, the form may be different, but the principles underlying them, I think that's what Plato was trying to get at. I think that's why he said, that an ideal chair or an ideal cup or an ideal book doesn't have a specific form, but it's an abstraction. And I think that's why the geometric shapes I was drawn to, because, and probably some of your listeners, because there is a quality of generalization that leads to abstraction that then can become a way of looking at the oneness of things. But I think since oneness is sort of a boggling concept to grasp, essentially a training wheels idea that gets us to that is interconnectedness and shared interests where we transcend polarization can help with that. So the last three laws of the Hermetic laws that are covered in the Geometry Code are the laws of rhythm, cause and effect, and gender. And there's three geometric symbols that I think fit very nicely with those. And that is the spiral for rhythm. If we look at how we're going around the solar system on planet Earth, for example, and the other planets, of course, in their own unique orbits, we can think in terms of, well, okay, it's just going around and around and around and around, around, kind of monotonous. But then a book by another colleague named John Martineau, who's a brilliant crop circle researcher, and also found that there are some models of the solar system that are incredibly accurate. I have some in the gallery page on Geometry Code. I have some examples of imagery that I did inspired by John Martineau's beautiful and brilliant little book called A Little Book of Coincidence, where he showed that you can actually take the orbits of the planets in our solar system and essentially make models of pairs of orbits in the planets of the solar system by approximating their orbits as circles, even though they're really ellipses. But most of them, except for Mercury and Uranus, I believe, are pretty darn close to circles, you know, certainly to the naked eye. And it turns out that you can have almost all of them are actually two-dimensional models with triangles, circles, squares, pentagrams, hexagrams, hexagons, and you can take these simple geometric models and show that the planetary orbits are very accurately described by these simple geometric models.
Okay, we got two more minutes for the last two laws.
Two more minutes, oh my gosh. Okay, so anyway, look for John Martineau if you're interested in those interesting models. And then the last two Hermetic laws are the law of cause and effect, which means everything in our world is a result of, again, back to the law of minimalism, an idea. Everything that we see is a result of either inclusive thinking or exclusive thinking. And so that basically gives us an opportunity to look at our thoughts again, bring it back to the center of the circle. And then the very last one is gender generation. So I think a fractal works really nicely for the law of cause and effect, because we can think of all the ramifications, all the branches of the tree that branch out from each cause into thousands of effects and millions and so forth. The law of gender generation, I think, is symbolized very nicely by the yin-yang symbol. And you can make a fractal version of that, too. But you have this interplay of the two circles within the larger circle that define this yin-yang shape that's constantly embodying all the other laws. And I think anything that's true has this holographic nature to it. So again, the yin-yang has all the other principles, Hermetic laws embodied in it, just as each of the other laws do. And each of the geometric shapes, essentially, because of the dual nature and the fact that they all nest inside each other, that's all interconnected. And we're all interconnected, which really, again, is a metaphoric way of saying that we're on our way back to the oneness that we never left. How's that?
Well, anyway, there we are, and this is Bruce Rawls and Star Fuentes telling everybody Happy Thanksgiving.
Yes.
Thank you for being here, Bruce.
Thank you, Star, for having me on your show. I really enjoyed it, and really appreciate you having me on to share with everyone. So.
All right.
On behalf of Spiritual Connections Radio, thank you for listening to Stargazing with Star Fuentes. Please join us again next week for another enlivening episode. For more information on Star's classes or services, visit her website at www.starfuentes.com or call the office at 501-609-0660. That's 501-609-0660.